Okay, everybody gather round. It's time for the big pen. Pull down. Kick out your heels. Jump up and down. Shut your eyes and whirl around. Reach out your hand and if no one's there, grab your own hand, dance round in a square.
When you're doing the big pen, hold down. Gotta have a collar you can trust.
Point. Oink. Oink.
All right, it is 5:58 live here from Fannin Tree Farm. Let us dive into Da Pig Pen.
I've told many, many stories about growing up in the country. I've told you guys many stories about playing in a metal band for the first several years once I moved to Dallas. I've been really transparent with a lot of stuff, but there are certain stories that will cross my mind, and I wonder, number one, how did I forget this? What brought this back to my mind, and how have I never told this story on the air? And I don't even know if I've mentioned, I think I've mentioned to you guys that I went scuba diving once in Grand Cayman. Remember me saying about the Grand Cayman trip?
Yep.
Okay. There's a backstory to that. And I like to call this my own personal fire festival. Okay? So back in probably 1990. So that would put me at, let's see, probably 21, 22.
What year is this?
Somewhere on there? Okay.
Yeah.
I was playing. It was right at the end of our run in Sahara Rain with me and the twins and Andrew. We had this drummer named Tommy. Tommy was older than us by probably, I think, about 4 or 5 years. But at that time, you know, we're 22. He's 27. You don't think of anything of it. Big deal. And he was pretty seasoned. He had done a lot of touring. He'd played with a lot more popular bands than we ever became. He went on to play. After we broke up, he went on to play drums with this band called Blue Murder. Now, you wouldn't know who Blue Murder is, but the leader of Blue Murder, he left Whitesnake after that big album that they had with Still of the Night, co-writer of Still of the Night and Here I Go Again.
So it was a huge deal.
His name is John Sykes.
Yeah.
And he started his own band called Blue Murder, and Tommy ended up going on and playing drums with Blue Murder. It was a very big deal at the time. Especially going along with somebody that was that notable of a songwriter, co-writer, whatnot. But around that time, it was nearing the end of that, some guy, and you know how there's always guys that have like an idea or a scheme, or they've, you know, gone and seen you play, and they really like you, and you develop some kind of a loose relationship with these people. Well, this guy got in contact with us and said, I'm putting together this mini festival, and I've got this great idea that I want to do it in Grand Cayman, the Cayman Islands.
This would have been like early 90s?
This is 89, probably.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there weren't a lot of festivals back then, period.
Well, I mean, when I say mini festival, I'm talking about two acts.
Okay.
Okay.
Right.
Basically, he wanted to put on a concert. At a cool place that, unless you're already going there, you're not going to see a couple of bands that you've never heard of.
Yeah.
So this was his idea. He wanted to put on a show that involved two bands that they would he would front the money to fly the musicians out there. He would rent the arena. He would take care of our lodging and all of our food. And he was a promoter, and he would promote this show to not only the locals, which there aren't a lot, I would assume, and the ones that are there are probably in the service entertainment industry themselves, because it is largely a tourist,
right?
A tourist island. So he was anticipating that the people that were there, the influx of tourism that was going on in that summer, I can't remember, maybe it was in the winter, I can't remember, whatever their peak season was, his idea was, I can get people that are down here to be outside, to go scuba, that are down there to scuba dive, hang out on the beach. Scuba diving is the main attraction there. I'm going to get them to spend $30 on a ticket to go see two bands they've never heard of and hang out indoors for 3 hours. He thought this was a great idea. So he fronted thousands of dollars. I think this whole package with him renting out the arena, the lodging for two acts, and the plane fare to and back to the States, to Grand Cayman, I think it ran him in excess of around $30,000. This was an investment that he was going to make up on selling tickets. He thought, I'll sell 500 tickets, and I'm going to make, you know, X amount of dollars or whatever, and he's going to make a profit. This was his whole idea. So we go to.
So you're not spending a nickel.
Not a dime. Nothing out of pocket. Unless we wanted to go out and eat. And by the way, I don't know if you've ever been.
I've never been.
But if you, and this was in 1989, keep in mind, when we got there, and I'll get to how we got there for in a minute. But once we got there and, you know, we were eating the food and it's just, you know, cold cuts and stuff like that. Stuff that you would fill a fridge with to feed, you know, a group of people in a timeshare type situation. You wanted to go to Pizza Hut and get a small pizza, one that's about that big because they had Pizza Huts there. In 1989, you were looking at a small pizza running you almost $20.
Oh, my God.
Yes, it's very, very expensive. 20 U.S. I don't know what the exchange rate is and how that played into it all, but the prices down there at the time were outrageous. So we were happy to stay on campus and... Once we discovered that, you know, a Big Mac was $11.
Oh, wow.
So, our band, we arrive at DFW, and we are to meet this other band from Baltimore that Tommy, our drummer, grew up with. He was a Baltimore guy. So he knew these guys, and it's like, yeah, I've got the perfect band that we'll get them to play with us, and they're really good, and they'll open up for us, and blah, blah, blah. And the name of this band was called Mad Dogs and Englishmen, a play off of the Joe Cocker record,
yeah,
I believe.
Cocker.
Yeah, yeah. And these guys were full throttle, Baltimore accents like you wouldn't believe. These guys going to go down to the ocean, you know,
yeah.
Drinking, heavy
game,
drinking,
yo.
Partied their buns off. We meet up with these guys, and it's like we were hanging out with Motley Crue for a week. And we're all mellow. We're just, like, chill dudes. Tommy was pretty wild, the drummer, but the rest of us were still pretty young in the game and a little green.
Yeah.
But, you know, we had a pretty good band for what it was at the time. So we meet up with these guys in the Miami airport, and, you know, you could tell immediately that it was a differing in culture and personalities. Is all these guys wanted to do is get sloshed 24 hours a day.
Right.
It's the first and only time I've ever smoked a cigarette on an airplane, because international flights back then, you could smoke, because you can't fly from Miami to Grand Cayman because it's international. That's a long flight. You're going to need your cigs.
God.
When those guys were back there smoking, because they
got
specifically
in the smoking section.
They requested it for their flight from Miami to Grand Cayman. And I remember going back to the bathroom. I was like, I've never even seen anybody smoke a cigarette on a plane since I was like 5. So they give me a drag of that. So I had to have a hit off one of the guy's cigarettes to say that I have smoked a cigarette on an airplane.
And wasn't it just separated by a curtain? Didn't they just put like a
No, it wasn't nothing? Even a curtain. It's just this seat is smoking. The one in front of it is non-smoking.
God.
Because when you're in the non-smoking section, the smoke from the back, you don't even notice it
at all. In an airplane.
In an airplane. We get to Grand Cayman. And the setup is great. Like, they've got it's basically they rented an apartment for us for, I think we were there 3 or 4 nights. And the fridge is stocked. There's beers. There's supplies, you know, sandwiches and all this other stuff that it's just, you know, like, hey, when you guys run out, here's a cell phone. Give us a call and we'll have somebody come over and fill up your thing for you. It's going to be great. We're going to take you guys scuba diving. We're going to go on a day dive. None of us were certified. So they had an end around on that. To get us, you know, fake certified so we could go on this dive. So we go and take this hour-long course where you're basically in waist-deep water and you're learning how to breathe with a respirator. And it's just glorified snorkeling. And learning how to operate the weight belt the buoyancy belt. Because you got weights on, but you've also got this air belt around you. So the idea is the weights bring you to the bottom. The air, you fill that up from your oxygen tank. That brings you to the top. And you find that happy medium to where you're not rising or you're not sinking.
Yeah.
And you're just...
It's pretty cool.
It's like you're flying. You can go
anywhere. Kind of learn how to work a clutch in a car.
Like, it's incredible.
Yeah.
It is. Scuba diving is probably the single most fun, unique experience I've ever had. So we go on a day dive that afternoon.
How many days before the show are you there? 1 or 2?
We had 2 days before the show, and then we were going to have 1 day after the show and then fly back the next morning. So I think we were there four total nights.
So it's a full vacation.
It's a vacation. It's a paid vacation with free scuba diving, which
at that age, by the way,
thousands of dollars for. None of us had ever done anything like that.
Yeah.
And everything's comped. All the red stripes you can drink.
Yeah.
All right. So we get down there. We do the scuba diving little course. And they take us out to this. It was some type of a boat wreck or a shipwreck. And it was a 30-foot dive. So a pretty decent, a decent dive. And we're swimming around this shipwreck. And we get to, see stingrays and grouper and all these different fish. Then at night, there's a night dive where it's a wall dive that you take your big old flashlight and you're able to go down this wall. And it's incredible, and you're just the colors, and at night it's just a completely different experience. So we all do that, and the show is coming up, and we start detecting a weird vibe from the promoter. Like communication's not great. He's becoming a little surly, and actually not being particularly nice to us anymore. We come to find out, and we didn't know how bad it was until we show up for the show, for sound check. So we show up for the sound check, and we're doing our thing.
How big's the room?
I believe the room was a very small arena that probably would have held 1,500 to 2,000
people. So like
people.
The Granada.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's a very small like arena, and it's all enclosed, air-conditioned. We show up for sound check. And we, go off-site and other band sound checks. I think they were opening. We come back, and I don't even think we got back in time to see the opening band. So they walk out, and we walk out on stage. And I know why the guy was pissed, because the guy was going to be out about $30,000. There were literally seven paid.
Oh, my God!
Seven tickets were sold.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Seven tickets at $30 each. The man made $210. So after that.
Oh, my God.
After that.
Were y'all mortified or were you laughing?
No, we felt terrible. I mean, we felt bad for the guy.
Yeah.
Because he was in such a great mood, and this was a great idea, and all these people that they're going to want to go see rock and roll. They're from all over the world, people from Britain and Germany and, Mexico. They're coming here to scuba dive, and they're going to want a night out on the town, and I've got the ticket for them. The problem is, he did very little, if anything, to promote the show at all. And I think even if he had flooded the island with promotion, it would have failed anyway.
Yeah.
Needless to say, the fridge after that, let's say it wasn't ever really restocked. The communication with this guy completely disappeared. There was no beer. There was no anything. And then finally, the next day, like after that show, we realized that we're out of food. We don't have any food, and we cannot afford to spend $30 on a pizza because we're all poor and broke. So the next day, that morning, he's like, yeah, I'll take care of you guys. Nothing happens. And finally, I think it was Tommy and Andrew, who were probably the alphas in the band, tracked him down and were like, this is not our fault. What are we supposed to do? How are we supposed to? This is on you,
right,
dude. And we're sorry that this happened, but this is on you. You promised to take care of us. The guy finally apologized and said, you know what? I took it out on you guys. I'm sorry. This was my fault. I didn't mean to be, rough with you guys, but you got to realize I lost my ass on this. So he apologized, and we got taken care of, and we got rides to the airport. We flew back, and we had a really good time overall. But there is one element of the trip that I'll never forget. It was kind of our fire festival because, yes, by the end of, before that last full day, we were literally eating like pieces of bread and wet cheese just because we were starving and there was nothing to eat. So one night, I think the guys had scrounged up enough money to pay for them to go out to a club. And because they had like some dance clubs in town that you could go hang out at, and I didn't go. I think me and the twins stayed back and watched television or something like that. And one of the bedrooms was upstairs, and Tommy, our drummer, was sleeping on the couch downstairs. So I end up going to bed, and it's late, and I kind of hear him get home, and I hear, I think, female voices and beers cracking and whatnot. And so I pass out, go to sleep. In the middle of the night, the bathroom is downstairs. in the middle of the night, I walk downstairs to go to the bathroom, and as I come downstairs, if you look straight ahead, it's a kitchen. If you look to your right, it's the living room, and he was sleeping on the couch. So I'm hearing some noises, so I turn around, and I look over to the couch, and it's one of the most unexpected lovemaking acts that I had ever seen up to that point that involved our drummer laying on his back, nude, with his legs in the air.
And, oh, God.
And the woman...
God!
Not doing the thing that you think she would be doing.
Yeah.
Doing things further around.
Yeah. And you, like, kind of
took a peek? And I just kind of peek around. I was like, huh. I never realized that was a thing, but... You go,
way to go, man.
You go, girl. And, yeah, I went and got my drink of water, went to the restroom, and went back upstairs and told Tommy the next day. And, oh, my God. I was like, I didn't want to see that at all, much less a dude that I have to see all the time.
Yeah, that's jarring. Yeah,
remember the drop of my German Shepherd?
Yes.
Of what she did to the burglar that tried to break in our backyard? That's what was happening.
God.
And I'd never seen that before as a young 19, 20-year-old. But, yeah, we made it back to the States safely, and we were all tired and had stories to tell, but that was our fire festival. Yes, we played in a 1,500-seat arena to seven people.
How long did y'all play?
We played the full show set? Like we were at Reunion
Like
Arena.
An hour and a half?
Yeah, probably an hour and 15.
God,
with
dude.
An encore.
We'll be right back.
Cool.
Seven people.
Seven people.
Like you could count them.
Yeah. Yeah. And it wasn't like they were all sitting together on the front row. There was like a guy over here, three people up here. It was like Spinal Tap and Puppet Show, or Puppet Show and Spinal Tap. That's how we felt. It was horrible. But I learned how to scuba dive for free, and it was awesome. But that's my personal fire festival.
That's badass.
Yeah.